home location. It was season one, so nobody had certainly seen the show, and we were on the second floor, in the bedroom of this house that these people had rented to this HBO TV show. Unfortunately, the people were still there on the third floor with their little child. They had just decided to stay on the top floor and let the crew have their bottom two floors. We were shooting the scene, and we had a Hungarian director who was very, very vocal and screaming things like, "Louder! Louder!" Then he many times screamed really loud, "Climax now!" Then you have to wait a little after he is done talking to actually do it so that they can actually cut the sound in. Anyway, this went on, and these people were listening to this. Apparently, they decided that night that their house was no longer available as a location for this trash show because they thought we were shooting porn. Everybody got such a kick out of it that the crew, as a wrap gift, made t-shirts that said, "The Wire, Season 1, Climax Now, Louder."
Dominic West, Detective Jimmy McNulty.
The camera was coming around the bed behind us. We couldn't see where it was. He said, "When the camera gets to your left shoulder, will you climax?" I said, "Look, I can't see the camera. I don't know when it's coming, and I'm concentrating on Dee Dee." He said, "All right, I'll shout." We'd get into it, and the camera would be coming around, and he's Hungarian, and he shouted, "Climax now!" We all fell about laughing. Yeah, that was the funniest sex scene I think we did. That was bloody funny.
Peter Medic, director.
That love scene was great. It was very sexy and very clean. When I do love scenes in movies, to take the curse off the nudity, I always shoot it in a circular way, around the bed, so the duvet kind of semi-hides what is going on. It's always so much better with love scenes to be very suggestive and beg everybody not to cover themselves up, because it's better to be completely naked when you make a love scene and can avoid showing both of the people very easily. But if they're strapped up, the ladies with all kinds of padding and things on the nipples, it always shows and it restricts you. It's much better just to hide it with the movement of the camera, and then it becomes very sexy. That really is one of my best memories of that episode.
Deirdre Dee Dee Lovejoy, Assistant State's Attorney Rhonda Perlman.
I had done one day on the pilot, and Dominic is literally lying on top of me. We're completely naked. He's got the little bag that covers the male parts, and I've got the pasties on. They're covering the female parts. He is lying on top of me, and he says, "Oh, this is weird. Last week I was on top of Renee Zellweger." He had just shot the movie Chicago. I was like, "Oh, thanks for that. That was really helpful to me."
Dominic West, Detective Jimmy McNulty.
What an asshole. Did I say that? Dear, oh dear, what a jerk. It was actually true. In Chicago, that's all I did. I came on, had sex with Renee, and then she shot me. Then Chicago starts. That was a hilarious scene.
David Simon, creator.
He has the kind of personality where he can say things and you just sort of go, "How did you get away with that?" I once stood behind him on an elevator. This was back in the early days before he was married. We had a beautiful day player in the scene, and she was only there for the day. Then she was taking the train back to New York. I stood behind him. He didn't know I was behind him. It was a crowded elevator, and he's only got this moment. She's headed for the Teamster van. He just worked a scene with her, but there was no time while they were working. You know what his pickup line was? She turned toward him, and she said, "You know, I just broke up with my boyfriend." And he looked at her, and he went, "Really?" And so later on, when she missed her train back to New York, I was like, "That's all you needed? Really?" I think for the next 2 years, I just kept going up to him whenever he was talking bullshit. "Really?" That was my code for "fuck you."
Ed Burns, co-creator.
That guy, they just flocked. And it's the most incredible thing you've ever seen. It's like the PA's production assistants would bump into telephone poles, that kind of thing.
Dominic West, Detective Jimmy McNulty.
I do think Americans are particularly forgiving with people's accents. I mean, if you listen to Mel Gibson in any of his heyday films, his American accent is terrible, but he got away with it.
Ed Burns, co-creator.
David and Dominic spent a lot of time. Now say it like police. Police. No, police.
Peter Garrity, Judge Daniel Phelan.
Dominic had a trailer as his dressing room, and he said, Pete, come here. Come on in my dressing room, my trailer, all right? And I said, yeah, what's up? He said, I need you to listen to me. I've got to get this Baltimore accent down because, of course, he's British. He actually does a really good American accent, but I sort of sat with him, and he just worked through stuff for a couple of days just to get his Baltimore accent closer. Not that I was all that great with it, but I think I helped him a little bit.
Dominic West, Detective Jimmy McNulty.
It never got any easier for me. It was a real problem for me, actually. I worked pretty hard on it. I think the producers felt that eventually perhaps I wouldn't need the coach anymore, but I did. I needed it right up until we wrapped the whole series. And it was a constant effort, particularly any time he got emotional or you started shouting. That's when you lose the accent and start going into your own accent. I always dreaded those scenes, and it was a pain in the ass. It would have been so much easier to have done it in my own accent, but I suppose that wouldn't have necessarily sounded right. I do remember meeting Idris for the first time, and he's got a London accent, and I was saying to him, fuck, what about this accent? Actually, I didn't realize he was English initially because he was talking the whole time in American, and he was living in New York at the time. I was chatting to him, and eventually he said, look, you've got to stop talking in that English accent because you're fucking me up. He was trying to do American the whole time, as a proper actor should. So we had to keep clear of each other for the first few weeks because we'd fuck each other up.
Idris Elba, Stringer Bell.
We would laugh about it. There was only one scene where we actually worked together. And as soon as he walks in, he was talking in his English accent. And I started talking in my English accent. And I said, mate, we're never going to be able to pull this off. He was laughing about it. I never really said to him, don't do it. It was more of a joke. It was really hard working with an English actor, and you're both playing Americans. It feels a bit fake.
Andre Royo, Reginald, Bubbles Cousins.
They were battling over who would lose their accent first. Idris won that bet. Dom would go in and out all over the place. Maybe he's Irish, maybe he's from Baltimore. Keep him drinking. Get some Jameson in him and cover up his accent.
Early on, HBO executives asked David Simon to cut a seemingly pointless scene featuring a shadowy figure named Omar who robbed drug dealers. His presence did not seem relevant to them in moving the story along. Simon asked them to wait. The introduction of Omar, he said, would serve as a placeholder for the character when he was reestablished later in the inaugural season. The request paid off. Television had never seen a character as full of multitudes as Omar Little, depicted brilliantly by Michael K. Williams. The role was the first major gig for Williams, a native of Brooklyn's East Flatbush, who had dropped out of school to pursue a dancing career. Omar wore a duster and a bulletproof vest, carried a .44 Magnum, and whistled the farmer in the dell as he stalked the streets, ringing fear in the neighborhood. Yet, he nurtured out-of-luck mothers, refrained from cursing, attended church with his grandmother, and showed a caring, tender touch with his gay lovers. As inconceivable as it sounds, Omar, too, was sourced from real-life inspirations. During his days on the force, Ed Burns found that stick-up artists roamed independently and often maintained their own set of rules while providing accurate information. He cultivated several into his best sources. Donnie Andrews, one of the primary inspirations for Omar, positively transformed his later life, becoming a consultant on The Wire. The guys that I knew, The Anthony Hollies, Shorty Boyd, those type of guys, they all had a code, Burns said. They all lived by something, and they hunted drug dealers. That's what they hunted. Donnie Andrews, he was ferocious. Ferdinand Harvin, this guy was amazing. He gave me a call one time and says, "You want to hit this house?" We got a search warrant, hit the house. It's three guys who are in their 50s. You don't see many guys in their 50s with shoulder holsters, with 45s in the shoulder holsters, at a table. It was a substantial amount of drugs on the table, but we didn't find all Ferdinand said was in there. I went outside and I called them up. I said, "We can't find it." He says, "I don't understand you. Every time I've been at their house, I find everything." I said, "Ferdinand, I can't put a gun down a guy's mouth. I mean, I'm willing to talk to the guy, but I can't do that." Alexa L. Fogel, casting director.
Michael Kay had auditioned for me for Oz. You keep very good records for all your auditions. I had to figure out which character it was that he had auditioned for, and I had to go back every season and go through every page until I could find him. I knew I had wrote in my notes that he had this scar, so that's how I refound him to have him in for The Wire. He made an impression. I knew I wanted to see him again.
Michael K. Williams, Omar Little.
I mean, it was odd. How many people walk around with a scar in the middle of their face? It's a very odd thing to see. When you really think about it, on my face, you know, my face got mauled over. It's jarring.
Ed Burns, co-creator.
We picked Omar primarily because of the scar. His first scene was him and his partner getting ready to go do a robbery, and the guy comes and gives him a sawed-off shotgun. He takes the shotgun, and Mike was the name of the guy who gave it to him. He starts walking away, and Michael Kay says, "Excuse me. Yes? How do you open this?" "It's a fucking shotgun, Michael." I'm standing right next to him going, "Oh, God, this is going to be so bad." And then he goes out there, and it looked like when he was in his crib, his mother gave him a shotgun.
Michael K. Williams, Omar Little.
My contract was for 7 episodes. I was guaranteed 7, and then after that, we'll see. The direction and the development of the character happened as the character in the show went along. It served the storyline and the authenticity of the story that David was telling to take Omar out at any given time. It was clear to me that that would be the case. No one knew when Omar was going to go. No one knew. He didn't have a trajectory for Omar. I was told that Omar would meet his demise at one point or another. I remember me being told that early on. When? How? That was up in the air. I went into every season like, now this could be it. His trajectory wasn't as thought out, in my belief, as maybe a Barksdale storyline or the String of Bells storyline.
David Simon, creator.
He was only supposed to be in 7 episodes of the first season. He misapprehended the idea of, "And then you're dead." We basically only contracted for 7, and we didn't have a pickup for another season. So I knew we weren't going to bring him back every episode, and I think he only comes on in episode 3. I don't think he's lying, but I've since seen his interviews, and I've joked with him about it.
Michael K. Williams, Omar Little.
I was a deer in the headlights, full on, in season 1.
Ed Burns, co-creator.
Omar is a composite of 5 or 6 guys that were my informants who were gunslingers. Each one brought a little something to the Omar character, and it became the present character. This guy, Anthony Holly, he was extremely soft-spoken, very gentle, and a ferocious gunslinger. I mean ferocious. He had a buddy that he always hung around with who was a younger guy. That might have been in the back of my head. His buddy was beaten to death by the drug dealers, and Anthony retaliated. That scene of the body slung across the car, that's probably how David and I came up with that, just by going over his story. Anthony and Donnie Andrews, when they were on your side, it was a 100%. was no games. They didn't play games. They trusted you implicitly, and I trusted them implicitly. They were solid. A lot of the other guys you would never turn your back on, but that's how that happened. Anthony never cursed, never raised his voice. He came out of his house one Sunday morning, and there must have been 6 or 7 guys waiting for him. If you go down the street, you could still see the pockmarks, the bullet holes where they shot. And that was a true violation because he went to visit his mother. That was Sunday. He was supposed to have a break. Didn't happen. They wanted him real bad, so I got him into witness protection and got him out of the city.
David Simon, creator.
Avon and Stringer are not Melvin, Williams, and Chin Farmer. They start from that starting point, but then you're grafting into all these different guys that you knew or heard stories about. There's elements of Maurice Peanut King. There's elements of Will Franklin. The characters become 10 different guys, and then the actors become themselves. They become totally somebody else. There's no one-to-one ratio for anybody. Omar's 6 different guys.
Michael Kevin Darnall, Brandon Wright.
I worked my first day on The Wire. It was awesome. I met Michael K. Williams and Lance Williams, who played Omar, and John Bailey. We got along really well. I met Dominic, Sonia, and Andre, and it was really great. It was awesome, but it was really hard. Because after that first day of work, I went home to my day job, because we had wraps so early in the day. I was telling my coworkers about this great day on set. They were asking me a million questions, and then something said, check your voicemail. I was having this aching suspicion. I called my voicemail, and one of my close friends, actress Amanda Fields, she had left me a message. I called, and she told me that my girlfriend had passed away. So it was like, holy shit. The best day of my life was suddenly the worst day of my life. I, of course, was frantic, and my boss said, go home, take care of yourself. I did, and the next day I was up at 5 in the morning to go back to The Wire. So that next day was not as great. I was really kind of in a daze. We filmed well into the night. We did the scene where we robbed the stash house, where Omar takes the shotgun and blows the guy's legs away. I just remember Peter Medic, the director. He was so frustrated with me. Uda, the cinematographer, she was like, Michael, you got to slow down. I was moving so fast, and I didn't tell anyone but my cast members and the makeup people, Debbie Young. So they didn't really know what was going on with me, but yeah, I was completely out of it that day.
Michael K. Williams, Omar Little.
I think it was about 2 or 3 days on set that I had been working before I even met David. He ran up on me one night when I was rapping, going to get my ride to go back to base camp to change, and he ran up on me, and he introduced himself, and he said, man, his exact words, if I'd known you guys, the 3 of you, and it was Omar, Michael, the guy who played his love interest, and Lance Williams, who played Bailey, and he goes, man, you guys know how to make it work. He goes, man, I wish I would have known in the beginning that you were going to bring it to where you were. Because I would have made you kind of like my Wild Bunch. I was like, what do you mean, Wild Bunch? He looked at me and said, you never watched the Western The Wild Bunch? I was like, no. That was probably the first and only homework that David gave me. He told me I was to go watch The Wild Bunch and another Western. Because he wrote Omar's Duster, The Wild Wild West, and the standoff with Brother Muzon and Omar in the alleyway. Those are an old-school Western thing.
David Simon, creator.
There were some of these guys who robbed drug dealers I knew all about. Some of them I didn't. Obviously, Donnie Andrews I knew. There was a duo that always worked together. Ed told me many stories about Cadillac and his partner. He told me the story, and somehow, in one of the stories he told, I assumed they were gay, that they were lovers. They were inseparable. They worked together robbing drug dealers for years and years and years. They lived together. I thought they were gay. So I looked around our universe and said, can anybody in this world be gay? Somebody ought to be. I knew lots of openly lesbian cops. I didn't know any openly gay male police, but I knew plenty of lesbian cops, proud ones. So Kima was an obvious choice. And then I looked around in the structured drug trade, and I could be wrong. I'm sure there are exceptions, but it seemed to me a very homophobic culture. But a guy on his own robbing drug dealers? That feels right. And hey, we have the example of Cadillac. It was like a year later when somebody was asking me a question in an interview, and I started to bring up that there was a duo in Baltimore, and Ed looked at me and said, "They weren't gay." In my mind, I'd used them as ballast to justify it, but I just got it wrong.
Michael K. Williams, Omar Little.
They kept writing. I knew that the dude was gay. All they kept doing, Omar rubs the boy's lips. Omar rubs the boy's hair. Omar holds the boy's hand. I'm like, don't gay people fuck? You know what I mean? Don't they kiss? Don't they grab each other? I was like, listen, we got to step it up. Michael Kevin Darnall was with it. And I'll never forget, he made me laugh. He said, when do you think it should happen? I wanted to tell him right after I cut that barrel, that double barrel shotgun, and say, let's go hunting. But he was like, don't tell me. Don't tell me, because if I know when it's coming, I might freeze up. Just go for it. Director Clark Johnson looked at me. He gagged. The dude, he was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Hold on. Stop the work. Run that back.
Michael Kevin Darnall. Brandon Wright.
Michael and I were sitting in that van once, waiting to shoot another couple of lines of dialogue. He was just sort of sitting there quietly, looking out in the distance. He said, you know, Michael, when this thing finally airs, we're going to get a lot of phone calls. He, more so than I ever could imagine, knew how big this Omar character was going to be. He was just prescient in that way. Just in the bottom of his heart, pit of his stomach, he just really had a feeling that this was going to be big. And it was. Look at what Omar became, and look what it did for Michael's career. Pretty amazing stuff. I really think that we were, perhaps, the first two men of color to have a kiss on national television. After Brandon is killed, to see the amount of vitriol and ignorance coming from the viewing audience, by making the mistake back then of reading comments on message boards and YouTube. As an artist, I was not afraid. I guess that's my ignorance as a young, eager artist. Then reality hit. It was like, there's a lot of ugliness in this world, and I don't think you were really ready for it. That's not to say that that's the overwhelming response, because the overwhelming response, of course, has been absolutely positive to this show, and to Omar and his relationships. Yeah, I think that was the big surprise for me. That there is a world of hate out there. There were things like, I'm glad that faggot is dead. People who will be like, Omar's a real man, or Omar's my nigga, but that little faggot bitch, his little red dick-riding bitch. Things like that, that kind of make you laugh, but then you're like, oh, that's pretty terrible. I think what hurt the most was the idea that a quote-unquote hyper-masculine gay person was okay, but a fair-skinned, soft-spoken, light-haired gay guy who people couldn't tell if I was black, white, mixed, Latino, they called me everything under the book. That somehow that kind of gay person didn't deserve to live, or that he was unworthy of any sort of admiration or love, that hurt. Even though, look at what Brandon did. He went to bat, and he didn't give up Omar's name. He sat and, of course, this is all off-screen, he sat and got tortured and got his life taken because he didn't give up Omar's name. That's not as macho or impressive as toting around a sawed-off shotgun and whistling the farmer in the dell. People, not everyone, but some people, forget about that aspect of Brandon. That he went out rather valiantly.
Michael K. Williams, Omar Little.
It was the first time I ever got an extreme close-up. It was on the wire. My knucklehead up in the full screen. It was on the wire. It was the scene where Omar says, "Omar, don't scare." That scene where he's being interrogated in the police department about who killed his lover, played by Michael. The director was Ed Bianchi, right? Ed wanted me to play it like no emotion, like cold, all bravado. It's like Omar the Terror. Uda was the DP, director of photography. She stood up. She had such a strong feeling when she was looking up through the camera. It was so intense. She said, "I think that he should have a little bit of softness, like a little more emotion to show that he has a little softer side. This man has lost his lover viciously. There should be something else there, not just all rage and terror." They started to argue. It became a thing. I have never seen it before or since in my career. When the DP felt that strongly about something, that they argued with the fucking director. But she did. If you know Ed, you know that Ed don't take no shit. You ain't gonna work. No, Ed don't take no shit. She had to bow down and play her position. But when it was all said and done, before them cameras rolled, she came up behind me and patted my shoulder. She said, "Find a way to give us both what we want." No pressure. No fucking pressure at all. All I know is when you go back and look at that scene where Omar says, "Omar, don't scare," and you look in his eyes, whatever you see there, that is me trying to give them both what they felt they needed to see. I'll never forget that.
Uda Brisewitz, cinematographer.
I would never, ever go behind a director's back and give opposite directions to what he or she has given the actor prior. That would be completely undermining the director. It's not my position as a DP to do that. And I know in my heart I would never have done such a thing. Yes, I have strong opinions, but I also tried never to argue with directors, but respect their word as the final direction, especially speaking performances. It's absolutely not my place to make my opinion heard in any way. It happened to me often, though, that sometimes actors would come up to me with a question regarding their performance. My answer to them always was, "Sorry, but I can't speak to this. You have to ask the director." And this is the absolute truth about how I carried myself as a DP on set. I am not sure what triggered Michael to have such a memory of that scene. I would never argue with directors, especially not with Ed Bianchi, who always was one of my favorites and who I respected very much. Michael and I had a great relationship. Maybe he is trying to give me credit here for something that just shouldn't be given.
The Wire allowed its audience space to interpret. It would not fully explain scenes, instead leaving viewers pondering the meaning of them for episodes, and sometimes seasons at a time. One early moment hammered that methodology home. In real life, Ed Burns and Harry Edgerton had worked the murder of Desiree Press, who had been dumped by one of Williams' lieutenants, Louis Cookie Savage. In retaliation, she had threatened to turn Savage into the state's attorney. A gunman killed her, firing from outside a glass window. Through that case, Burns and Edgerton unearthed Savage's connection to Melvin Williams. In a storyline that recalled Press's killing, Jimmy McNulty and Bunk Moreland visit the apartment of a murdered young woman in episode 4. They quickly discover that the previous detective bungled the investigation, and they slowly and methodically retrace the murder and link it to Avon Barksdale's conspirators. Television had never seen anything quite like it. McNulty and Bunk converse in the nearly 5-minute scene by using only iterations of the word fuck. Simon credits the scene as an ode to Terry McLarney, a detective sergeant and a fixture in Homicide: A Year on the Killing Streets. David Simon, creator.
We're standing at a crime scene. We're staring, and cops are just cursing left and right. Somebody said something that was so profanity-laden that Terry McLarney just started giggling and saying, "One day we're going to get to the point where we're all going to be able to just use the word fuck to communicate." And it was just a throwaway line for Terry, but I remembered it. So I came to Ed with it, and then Ed wrote that scene.
Ed Burns, co-creator.
Terry is an amazing guy. He might even still be on the force. He was telling David basically these homicide things are so matter-of-fact it just becomes a matter of grunts. I wrote it and I used four variations of the word fuck. What the fuck? Oh fuck. Fucked up. But just four, and the actors were uncomfortable with the four lines, so then he was like, fuck, 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 fuck. And I asked the director, just give me the one. Get them to do the fucking job that they're being paid for. And I went to them and I said, we need the one. It turns out that David used the fuck, 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 which to me is like, wait a minute. The scene is about this harmony of doing an investigation, and they're so used to it. But we ended up with the fuck, fuck, fuck because it was a little bit, apparently, more fun. I didn't particularly see it that way, but it was fine.
Wendell Pierce, Detective William Bunk Moreland.
David comes up to us and describes a scene. He says, you're going to do the scene. You're going to realize that the previous detective, he did a bad job. Wendell, you're going to see the photos of the girl. Dominic, you're going to start getting the stats, looking at what the report was. Going back over, you're going to realize it's impossible to have gone down the way it was reported, because the guy would have had to be like 8 feet tall to get that trajectory. If he did, then something must be left in here. And you're looking for any evidence that may be around. And Wendell, you discover that there's a shot through the window. The glass is on the inside. It means it came from outside. That means whoever the perpetrator wasn't inside, like the person they say in the report. The bullet came from outside. From there, let's see the trajectory. It would be right here, in the refrigerator. Let's see. Not in the wall. In the refrigerator. You find the bullet here. Let's go outside, make a new discovery. He explained the whole scene to us. He said, now you guys are going to do that whole thing, but they're going to be on me about the profanity and language that we use. So I said, let's just come out the box with it. He said, you're going to do that whole scene, but the only word you can say is fuck. I said, what?
Clement Virgo, director.
I wanted to really let the audience in and know exactly what was happening visually. It took a long time to shoot that scene, but I wanted to get it right. I wanted it to be kind of like the shower scene in Psycho, where it was a lot of setups. The story was told visually, and so I was very detailed in shooting that scene. I remember our cinematographer, Uta, shot the whole thing. We shot the whole thing handheld. And I remember looking over at her, and she was wiped out from holding the camera for a long time. I really wanted to get all the kind of little details, and I wanted the audience to not have any mystery about what was happening in the story.
Wendell Pierce, Detective William Bunk Moreland.
I think it's an example of one of the best displays of my acting in the whole series. I tell folks, study that if you want to study what intent is, because everyone understood exactly what we were doing at every moment, even though we were using just that one word or a variation thereof. That was one of the best acted scenes that I did on the show. The one thing they cut out that I regret is we said, fuck, fuck me, what the fuck, fuckity fuck, all of that. Then we were being watched the whole time by the super. Fuck, motherfucker, fuck. We go outside and we find the casing, and the super says, well, I'll be fucked. They cut that out, though. I was like, oh, man, they should have left that in.
Dominic West, Detective Jimmy McNulty.
Every time someone said cut, we were crying with laughter, Wendell and me, because it was really fun to do. It would get outrageous. Sort of go, fuck, and fuck. Most of which hit the cutting room floor, thank goodness, but it was just the most ludicrous varieties of saying fuck that we could think of.
Throughout The Wire's run, David Simon filled it one question often. How could a white man adequately tell a story so intimately linked to the experience of blacks? He will grow weary of the question and try to allow his work to speak for itself. The fact is, he would have failed as a reporter covering the crime beat had he not learned to listen and interpret the demographic of the city he reported on. Behind the scenes, Simon attempted to groom young black writers and directors. He was a fan of Spike Lee and hoped Lee would direct an episode of The Wire, although talks over this collapsed. Simon has conceded that he probably missed aspects that black creative minds could have spoken to more capably. Often, he would be tested with his cast on his intentions. It started with Sonia Sahn in the first season. Wendell Pierce, Detective William Bunk Moreland.
The first year, Sonia and David bumped heads. David Simon said, "It's a show with no hope." Sonia went off.
David Simon, creator.
What I was saying to her is effectively what the show said, which is, this is going to be a cruel world and nothing's going to get fixed that matters systemically. Systemic. I was going to promote all the wrong people, and the same policies were going to go on. Regardless of any conversation I had with her, that's how the show ended. But she's right. The characters themselves, as individuals, were entitled to a certain figure of dignity at points. Some of them, anyway. As it should be. Even in a rigged game, people don't cease to be human, and the human heart doesn't stop beating. But at the time that I said it, I think we were arguing past each other. She was talking about characters, her character, other characters, and I was talking about the systems that we were depicting. I think the system part of the show was more in my head and Ed Burns's head than in the people who were being asked to depict the world. Because it has to be. You're asking them to be in the moment. And human beings in the moment, we all live as we live. We're not constantly standing back and going, let me have my omniscient moment of seeing the whole. Actors are particularly susceptible to seeing the world powerfully from the point of view of their characters. It's what their job is. You never tell an actor who's about to do a bad thing, you're a bad guy. I'm always telling my actors when they're about to do something bad or something morally transgressive, you're a good guy. This is a bad moment, but you're a good guy. Because unless you're a total sociopath, which very few people are, the people doing bad things are still people. And the people having noble moments are still people, and the next moment they'll do a bad thing. I think in some ways we weren't even applying the terms in the same way, but I do remember butting heads with her. Because she's a progressive optimistic person, and I'm a progressive pessimistic person.
Sonia Sahn, Detective Shakima Kima Greggs.
It's really important to know that the context of my understanding of the business, my knowledge of who David was, is very different now than it was then. My perspective now has adjusted a little bit from what it was at the time. Because of David's experience, 20 years on the streets of Baltimore, and now that I have been on the streets of Baltimore, I fucking get it. I thought that he was losing it in that blanket statement. Today, I understand the truth of that statement, where he was coming from, because he really was talking about the systemic, structural, racist policies that inevitably are going to keep a large number, if not the majority, of people struggling to survive in the hood. I didn't understand structural, institutional racism at the time the way I understand it now, so David was really making that statement more from that perspective. For me, I was someone who had spent a lot of my childhood, a lot of my life, making sure that I was not going to be one of the people that was going to stay oppressed and suppressed by my environment. I found that statement appalling because I knew that even though I didn't grow up in Baltimore, I did grow up in a comparable environment. I grew up in an underserved community that was dealing with a lot of those poor issues. Even though it was a generation earlier and it looks different in the 70s, the core issues were the same. I had worked my way out of having to live in survival mode. I had worked my way into a place where some people call it the beginning of life's success. All I had was my own hopes and dreams and the knowledge that I was going to escape the traps. When David said that, it just struck me as a real sour note. I also knew there were some guys who were actors who had all transcended those environmental obstacles to be on the show, to get to a place in life where they could have a successful acting career. We were the hope. We were evidence that it's possible. All of us, not just actors, but all of us who have come from those backgrounds have acquired some level of success in the world. We are the hope for those who are struggling.
Lance Riddick, Lieutenant Cedric Daniels.
Somehow, I was alone with David, and we just got to talking. I asked him something. I remember him saying, organizations can't be reformed, but people can. I remember being struck by it when he said it, because I knew that I had never thought of it that way, and I knew that there was something profound in the inside. Then, over time, particularly when I watched the show, I realized how we see both on the criminal side and on the police side. You see people struggling to live up to the codes of the institutions that they're a part of, and seeing how it chips away at their humanity.
David Simon, creator.
I had told him it was much harder to reform a system. The thing that reforms systems are trauma, great trauma. Nobody gives up status quo without being pushed to the wall. I believe that, politically. The great reformations of society are the result of undue excess and undue cruelty. The reason you have collective bargaining in America and it became powerful is that workers were pushed to the starvation point. The reason that you have the civil rights we do is that people were hanging from trees. The notion of the system being self-reforming, without incredible outside pressure, and without first bringing about incredible trauma through inhumanity or indifference, I find that to be really dubious. I'm arguing for reform. It's not like I can say this and we should throw up our hands and can't try. Every day you gotta get up. I'm saying this with the clarity of, there's no choice but to try.
Over time, the name of the novelist George Pelicanos kept popping up in conversations David Simon was having. Carrie Antholis, the HBO executive, originally recommended that Simon read Pelicanos' book, The Sweet Forever. Simon took the suggestion as needling. He owed Antholis late scripts for The Corner and interpreted the earnest recommendation as a prod for him to hurry. Simon and Pelicanos finally talked at the funeral of a mutual friend. The pair, standing next to each other, believed that the friends and family of the deceased bookstore owner would gently place the first layer of dirt on the grave in traditional Jewish burial fashion. Instead, a backhoe jumped to a start and began piling dirt onto the plot. "Is this traditional?" Pelicanos asked, turning to Simon without a trace of a grin on his face. "Is this traditional for you guys?" "He cracked me up," Simon recalled. "He just slayed me. I was no good for the rest of the day. I was like, man, not only is he a good writer, he's funny. Dark and funny. I sought him out after that." Pelicanos became a needed third voice, and in some cases tiebreaker, for the creative forces of Simon and Burns during the run of the show. Simon entrusted Pelicanos to author many of the show's fine-grained scenes, and he wrote the season's penultimate episodes, which often killed off major characters, beginning with the gut-wrenching murder of Michael B. Jordan's Wallace by his friends Bodie, J.D. Williams, and Poot, Trey Chaney, in season one. Eventually, actors began flipping to the back of any script Pelicanos had written to make sure their character had survived. George Pelicanos, writer and producer.
David Simon's wife, the novelist Laura Lippman, and I both knew this woman who passed, and we went to the funeral, and David was there. Laura, unbeknownst to me, had given David one of my books, and it happened to be a book called The Sweet Forever, which is one of my deep, sort of urban novels from that period. It was very close to what he was doing. It was kind of fortuitous that he read that book in particular.
David Simon, creator.
My wife and I had just started dating then. My wife's a novelist, and she was a contemporary of George's. She'd been on me to read George. She goes, you should read Pelicanos. He's interested in the same stuff. His heart is where your heart is. And I'm like, yeah, he's from D.C. I had that Baltimore thing like, I'm sorry, those are the lawyers who come to the Orioles games and sit there on their cell phones for five innings. Fuck those guys. And I'm from D.C. originally, so I had sort of like a Baltimore chip on my shoulder, so I hadn't pulled one of his books up.
George Pelicanos, writer and producer.
I didn't have a ride back to the Shiva. He says, ride with me. I want to talk to you about something. I ride with him, and he says, I've got this show. Would you want to write an episode? Would you like to try it? I said, sure, I'll try it. I didn't know David at all, even though he grew up just about 3 or 4 miles from me. Then we went to Maryland together, but I didn't know him at Maryland. He's a little bit younger than me, and he was involved with the Diamondback, the school newspaper there. I wasn't involved with anything. When I got out of classes, I went to my job, which was selling women's shoes. Even when he first approached me to write for the show, he didn't overdo it. He said to me, yeah, I've got a show. I just sold the pilot to HBO. It's about drug dealers and cops in Baltimore. That sounds pretty basic, right? I had watched Homicide for the whole run, but especially The Corner, which had been on already. I saw what he had done. The Corner is sort of a blueprint for what The Wire was going to be. I knew what he was capable of and where his heart was politically and socially, and actually that's what convinced me to give it a shot. I think, in a very broad sense, he's always had the overarching idea in his head of this show and what he wanted to do with it. He's a macro guy. If you say to me, go write a book about the drug war's failure, it would probably intimidate me. I'm more of a micro guy. I like to dig into the characters and the individual scenes and dialogue. But David knew what the big picture was. My first script for The Wire, I wrote it and turned it in, and I can't even remember if David gave me any notes. When I got the published script, let's say about 30% of what I had written was in the final script. I called David up, and of course I said, what happened to my script? If I remember correctly, he had Jim Yoshimura in the room with him for some reason. They were hanging out. He's friends with Jim. They worked together on Homicide. They were on speakerphone, and David says, hey, Jim, Pelicanos got 30%. He's complaining. And David said, that's pretty good to get 30% your first time.
David Simon, creator.
It's hard to get into the voice of a show that is not your initial creation. You're flying one plane and on the runway. Other people in the control tower are looking at the whole screen. Some things you did perfectly well, but the script came in before you went in a different direction, or the script that's coming after you has to do something that you're not setting it up right. Maybe because the beat you were given was imprecise. Maybe because you veered in a way that was worthy for your script, but doesn't work for the whole. There's all these variables that can conspire against even a perfectly fluid and competent writer when they turn in a script on a continuing series.
Andre Royo, Reginald, Bubbles Cousins.
A long time ago, David was like, do you want to be an okay television show, or you want to be a classic television show? This is not Walt Disney. People have to die. It doesn't matter if you kill one actor that's in a couple of scenes. If the audience doesn't care about the actor you're killing, then you haven't done your job. They gotta care about this person. We knew that was the theme.
Michael B. Jordan, Wallace.
Once my character started taking drugs a little bit and started sniffing coke, I kind of knew there was a slow decline.
David Simon, creator.
I said it to Michael. People are going to remember Wallace. Wallace is going to bother them for a long time after the whole show is forgotten. You're going to work. You're going to have a career. You did great with this. They all look at you like, this is the last job I'll ever get. You can never convince them enough.
Michael B. Jordan, Wallace.
I kind of knew it was coming. Especially when you get that knock on your trailer door from David Simon. I'll never forget it. He said, I love you. The audience loves you. We've got to kill you. We've got to kill you off. I remember telling my mom not to show up on set that day. My mom gets extremely emotional, and this was kind of too much. I didn't want her to see it. It was a long time to shoot that shot. We definitely overshot that for sure. I remember them having to duct tape the windows so the light wouldn't go through because we were going so late into the night to the morning. But it was really quiet. The crew knew. Everybody showed up. Even if they weren't working, they kind of showed up on set. I know Andre Royo did for sure. He was definitely a mentor of mine on that show. He showed up to help me get into the mindset and really talk me through it. I remember getting a squib under my shirt. They had a tube running down my leg with warm water for when he peed himself, when he got scared and shit. Me and J.D. Williams, who played Bodie, were both from Newark, New Jersey, and we both spent a lot of time on that show together. And I learned a lot from him over that show. We was just talking to each other, and then when we started shooting the scene, it was like I didn't even know him.
George Pelicanos, writer and producer.
That was shot as I wrote it. I was fortunate because I had these extraordinary actors doing the scene. I heard that it was a very emotional day on set because everybody loved Michael B. Jordan.
David Simon, creator.
I gave him the Wallace scene because at that point I had read 3 or 4 of his novels, and his violence was never gratuitous. It's always on a human scale, and it had a narrative tension that was that of a novel. So I always knew that those things would always have heart, and I thought he was the best person to chase that stuff. That was use what you have. To have a novelist's sense of tension when it comes to violence is really picture perfect.
Ed Burns, co-creator.
It was Pelicanos who wrote that murder scene, and I didn't like it. We made Bodie a psychopath, and psychopaths don't hesitate. It was great for the character growing, I won't deny that. It was great for the actor. Really gave him a stretch. He turned out to be a great actor, but to me, it didn't follow the logic of who the kid was. You create a psychopath, there's no moral sense of having him not pull the trigger.
David Simon, creator.
I was listening to Ed, but I'm also listening to George, and one of them had a better argument. Once you read George's scenes, there was something surprising. Bodie seemed to be heading for this moment the whole time. If somebody goes exactly where they say they're gonna go always, human beings aren't like that. The Chekhovian model of character is people don't say exactly what they mean. They say what they think other people want to hear, or what they want to hear themselves. They don't say exactly what they're thinking. They're not that blunt. They have a roundabout way of avoiding certain truths. Then they find themselves as contents under pressure. And then there are different outcomes. Sometimes that makes for the best moments in drama and also the most interesting moments in real life. People are contradictory. I felt like I was watching Bodie become a more interesting character. You can see the dividends that got paid on it in season 4. It's a self-reflection on his life. You couldn't have him just blot out Lawless. I couldn't do anything ever with him again. It would have stunted him. That would have been it. There's nowhere to go with that character at that point other than have him perform various acts and be serviceable to the plot.
J.D. Williams, Preston, Bodie, Broaddus.
It wasn't an emotional thing for my character. Bodie, he tries not to step over the line, but once he's over the line, he's committed. That's where he was going with it. Throughout the day, you might have been seeing Bodie's apprehension or him thinking about what he has to do. Then there is that flash in the room where he's like, he should have stayed away. But at the time, I was feeling it should have been just more resolute. The way I had been playing the character all that season, he was pretty committed to certain things he was doing, whether it's walking out of the juvenile hall or punching out an old man cop. I felt like once he made a decision, he pretty much stuck with it. It worked. I didn't think either one of us is wrong, because the audience loved the fact that Bodie did feel. They could tell that he felt compassion, which I think they would have been able to tell anyway. The audience loved that fact, and the point still got across that Wallace's death was tragic.
Trey Chaney, Malik Poot Carr.
I had just experienced a loss, a death in my family. This guy that was like a brother to me was abducted and killed, and he was like my best friend. As you could see, the way the scene was set up, it was set up for whatever it was, but I think the emotion for me came from my reality.
Michael B. Jordan, Wallace.
I don't think there was a dry eye in the house. I think everybody was kind of affected by that one, man. Everybody was fucked up.
Lawrence Gilliard Jr., D'Angelo Barksdale.
I think it was his mom came to me like, can you talk to him? I'm like, bro, you're talented. You're young. Don't stress it. It's just a job. You'll move on. You'll move on from this and you'll get on something else that's great. Just keep doing your thing. That's all we can do as actors. It's hard when you're doing it, but you gotta remember that it is just a job.
J.D. Williams, Preston Bodie Broaddus.
He was going through it. I had to pull him to the side. I explained to him, I said, first off, a death scene? This is where that theater training comes in. Because that's the main thing you want to do on the stage, is die. You can't do any more acting than that. I tried to explain to him that a death scene is an honor. And it's very important, because once you die, the people are going to start looking for you. They're going to say, well, he was great. I loved that character. Who was that guy? Because you did your job. Now you're going to be embedded in people's emotions, and they're going to be looking for you, and they're going to root for you because of the sympathy. This is going to be good for you. He calmed down some. He got himself together. He shot the scene, and as soon as the director yelled, cut, as soon as he hit the floor, he sat up, and he started crying.
Michael B. Jordan, Wallace.
You just get into it, and then you just go from there. Yeah, man. Went through it, got shot. Then I remember we did it a couple times. I want to say we did like 2 takes, 3 takes, and then I took a break or something, and I went out. I just remember my mom bawling, hearing her sob. I remember hearing her crying, and I'm like, oh, God. The whole emotional thing. That was cool. That was an intense night.
Clark Peters, Detective Lester Freeman.
I've put it to my agent. Don't give me jobs where I'm getting killed off all the time. Please don't. It sends the wrong messages to people. There are actors who really like to and will die really good. Give real good death scenes. Give the job to that cat. I want to live to play another day.
George Pelicanos, writer and producer.
The tragedy was that Wallace couldn't leave. He couldn't leave his environment. And he kept coming back. I think that's what I wrote in that episode. This is me, yo, right here, like I'm Baltimore. I'm not going anywhere. He even goes out to the country for a while, and he can't stand it, and he keeps going back.
Michael B. Jordan, Wallace.
Wallace was the heart of the show. David wanted to rip that heart out and really use Wallace as a harsh example of sometimes being the victim of your circumstances. Good kid, good heart. He had good intentions. And you could see with that environment what those types of circumstances can do to a kid like that. All these guys may be looked at a certain type of way. All aren't what they maybe seem to be. I love that symbolism and what that stood for. And to see that end so viciously with his two boys, his two best friends. That death scene was something people always come up to me and talk about, and say how they were crying and how much it affected.